Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. You may not be aware of this, but right across Australia, there is a secret cabal at work. Its members include lawyers, doctors, homemakers, and even editorial cartoonists for major newspapers. Each day, these people receive coded instructions printed in the newspaper. The effect of the activities of this shadowy group on our economy and our way of life is unknown, and I can tell you they have links with similar-minded cabals all over the world. They are, of course, the cryptic crossword puzzlers of Australia, and my guest today is their dark mastermind. His name is David Astle, better known as DA to his acolytes who obey his commands unthinkingly. David Astle writes the cryptic crosswords that appear regularly in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. And if you're like me, and you've never had any success whatsoever with a cryptic clue, David Astle has written a very witty guide to the crossword called Puzzled, Secrets and Clues from a Life Lost in Words. David Astle, welcome.
Thank you very much,
Dark
Richard
Feidler. Mastermind.
That was a wonderful introduction. Although, rather than cabal, I prefer coterie, because if you pluralise coteries and mix it up, you get esoteric, and we are an esoteric bunch.
Can you? I want you to keep doing that all
yes,
all this conversation.
Of course.
Can you keep doing that?
I will rifle my imagination, because rifled is an anagram of your surname. It's only fair.
Well, I put my name through, my producer put my name through one of those anagram generators because I'm such a dullard, I can't do it myself. And the best one we came up with for my name is Arch Riddler, if.
Oh, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Well, in fact, Riddler was one of my boyhood heroes. Not the Batman, but the Riddler. So I think we're... We may well be on equal footing here.
Indeed, I have a bit of the Riddler here. This is what I've managed to bring to you today.
What is it that no man wants to have, yet no man wants to lose? A lawsuit. Correct, boy wonder.
How do you make a dishonest shortcake?
Dishonest shortcake?
There's strawberry shortcake.
And blueberry shortcake.
A dishonest shortcake.
I've got it. A library. That would make it a dishonest shortcake.
Right, Robin. Library, clearly a corrupted version of the word library.
Riddle me this, Batman. What are the chilliest 12 inches in the world?
It's the Riddler. The chilliest 12 inches in the world, cold feet.
You know, I mean, libraries is a wonderful word too because, in fact, it starts with a zodiac sign, Libra, ends with a zodiac sign, Aries, just as bullion with bull and lion does a similar trick. But I'm sure that the Riddler would also know that treacherous shortcake actually suggests that if you mix up shortcake, you get track shoe. So I would have gone looking for the bank money in track shoes.
How do you do that? How do you do that just off the top of your head like that?
Oh, look, it really is a life of swirling letters around. In fact, what you're seeing is, you know, essentially I'm an outpatient.
I played around with Julia Gillard in the anagram generator and got dual jail girl. And Tony Abbott came up with Natty Boob with a spare B at the end there.
he'd be thrilled to hear that because there's a transsexuality about Gillard as well because mixing up that surname is Lad and Girl, which I always find fascinating. So she's one of those rare people who hold two opposites in the same way that the word Stolichnaya, the vodka, if you mix it up, you get holy and satanic.
Wow. So this is going on your head all the time then,
incurably,
David.
It is.
When you do that, when you play with anagrams the way you do, I'm guessing that what's going on in your mind is that the letters become like Scrabble letter tiles and they just start to flip around. Is that what's going on in your mind?
It is. In fact, coming into the studio, just passing suburb names, I can't help but just treat everything I see as a Scrabble rack. Language is flexible. That's how I see letters. I see them as being pliable, and if my will and wit are, you know, sort of on working on the day, then I can create a sort of hidden meaning from what I see.
I spoke to Professor Roddy Sussex, who loves language, of course, and talks on the radio about language all the time. And his word of the day a couple of weeks ago was syzygy, spelled S-Y-Z-Y... I've lost the Y's and Z's again. Syzygy. And you know what that means, don't you?
It's an alignment of the planets. Mm-hmm. It's in the same ballpark as an eclipse, but don't ask for anything more precise
at this stage. But... I understand, using a word like syzygy, you tried to compile a crossword with no vowels.
It was a complete exercise in lunacy. And obviously there will be some listeners who will quibble that a Y is in fact a vowel. It's called a pseudo-vowel or a vocalic vowel, or it's because it serves the function of a vowel. But it was madness, Richard. I had a interlock that involved Lynyrd Skynyrd, rhythms, all those sorts of gypsies and dryly and things like that. It was impossible to extend into a 15 by 15 grid, but... That's the kind of ambition I like to apply to a box.
I mean, that's like five or six words you've just given me there. Mm-hmm. Does it extend much further than that?
Look, there's quite a few words that are sort of fives and sixes, but to get that sort of length of Lynyrd Skynyrd, that's where you really, that's the rarity. So that had to be the central plank, and all these small capillaries with Y only had to radiate from that.
Ah, so the crossword is, well, there's a plank with capillaries, but is it a living thing, the crossword, to your mind?
Yes, look, in fact, probably a better word than plank would have been a spinal column.
Yes.
And then the capillaries. That would make the metaphor... compatible, and also that's how I see it. I see a crossword grid, the blank grid, as this potential cosmos, this potential organism, and it's for me as the kind of creator to add all the right elements. From the scaffolding of the skeleton, that is the central and chief entries, and then all those small veins and venules and arteries that radiate outwards. And consequently, you create this universe that is within this small checkered box, and people get lost in there, including myself.
Tell me how this sort of grew in your mind as a kid. You mentioned the Riddler was your superhero slash villain of choice. Watching Batman as a kid,
he was, and in fact, I did love the superhero genre as a child, but my affections just gravitated towards the villains only naturally because they were often the ones who were creating puzzles, and while I did side with the detectives for the challenge of solving. It was the affinity I felt for the puzzle makers that saw me side with the villains. And that just seemed to naturally cascade into a fascination with newspaper puzzles. My grandma was a keen Scrabble player. I was fascinated by that game. So there was all these genetic and cultural knock-ons that saw me become who I am.
Tell me about the first time you saw your mum do a cryptic crossword.
It was at the drive-in. In fact, I had seen her do many crosswords before then, and I envied the rapture that she experienced.
Rapture, that's an interesting word.
Oh, it's a lovely word, and it's the word that I feel when I sit down to compose or to solve a crossword. If I can invoke another famous US sitcom or program, it does feel like a cone of silence descends upon me. I saw that as a child in my mum when she was doing crosswords. No matter the madness that was going on around her with four kids and we also had an absent father for a few years he was working as a sea captain. So our house was always chaos central. But mum would always just ply a little half hour of her day aside to sit down and match her wits against the Sydney Morning Herald's crossword. And while I was running around with my brothers and sisters, you know, throwing sand bombs and making a mess, one part of me was looking at her and wondering what it was that was so engrossing.
So how does it engross? It sounds like what you get from reading a novel, a good, really good novel. That it's something that takes you right out of your own self, your own life, into someone else's mind for a while, which is a break. That's kind of the best kind of holiday in a lot of ways.
It is, and I also think music, of course, does that too. It's a very, a core or chthonic hunger we have as humans.
Chthonic's a fine word too.
I think we should revise that. Tell
Please.
That one to Rolly next time.
I will.
C-H-T-H-O-N-I-C, and it means primordial. Yeah. So anyway, it is a primordial hunger that we experience, that need to transcend and that need to be enveloped in another sort of reality. And it's why we always, you know, the Greeks discovered this with you know, the dramatics just as much as the cave drawings in Lascaux with their artwork. It does seem to be this continual need to escape.
Can you remember the first cryptic crossword clue that was explained to you or you were able to nut out that had that snap moment to it?
Yeah, it was a snap moment, and it was at the drive-in, which was probably about perhaps in that same calendar year when I was noticing Mum's distraction.
How old were you?
I would have been about 7 or 8.
What was the movie, by the way?
The movie actually was a James Bond double bill. And I seem to recall it was definitely Thunderball was one of them and possibly on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Although, for once, I wasn't so distracted by an escapist movie because I found such pleasure in an escapist diversion of a crossword.
I diverted you just then, I think. But what was the clue? Do you remember?
You did. And it was follow in green suede shoes.
Follow in green suede shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Follow is an instruction, isn't it, of some kind?
Every clue, and you're getting warmer in your green suede shoes, stalking the quarry. Every clue, with very few exceptions, is composed of a definition element and a wordplay element. And the art of solving a cryptic crossword is to identify which part of the clue is which, because one may the definition may come second or first, you don't know. But you're quite right. In this case, follow is the definition.
Oh, it's the definition. Is that the same thing as an instruction then? No.
No, in fact, in the wordplay element, and these can take the form of about 8 different recipes, if you like, and maybe anagram, it may be double meaning, it may be reversal, it may be homophone. In this case, it's called a hidden. And, for example, if you look inside opera singer, hidden inside opera singer is erasing. So it's looking for words that are hidden within longer words or phrases. If you look inside macaroni cheese, you see niche. If you look inside medicine man, you see cinema. But in this case, the key phrase is green suede. That's S-U-E-D-E. And if you look inside that, you will find a word meaning to follow.
Ensue. So that's it. I was thinking Elvis or something like that, or Carl Perkins. I don't know. So that's the wrong way to think, really, isn't it? That's the quick crossword way.
Fell into the classic trap because
literalism.
Literalism, and what cryptic crossword solving and setting promotes is lateralism.
Lateralism, and that's the joy of it. Then is it?
It is the joy, and in fact,
sideways jump of the mind.
Look, mesmerism ensued.
How did two puzzlers then live in one house once you took up the cryptic crossword with you and your mum, David?
I think two heads are better than one when it comes to solving crosswords. And I think it got to the stage where we actually had to buy two separate papers because we were almost warring over the one puzzle. And she did prefer to have that little moment of solitude and her own rapture without, you know, I was going to say prodigy, but Brad is probably better. Chewing her ear.
David Astle is my guest in conversation, better known to his fans as DA, the man who compiles the cryptic crossword regularly for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and his book is called Puzzled, Secrets and Clues from a Life Lost in Words. So this skill you had became, it developed very, very rapidly by the sound of things. How was this useful for you as a rugby player?
Well, in fact, for those who don't know rugby, and I'm sure that most listeners do, but there is a very important part of the game called the line-out, and it is incumbent upon each team to have their own code that identifies where the ball is to be thrown in that line. If you imagine a bus queue of 8 rugged commuters and a ball is about to be lobbed on one of those commuters, and within that queue is someone who loves puzzles, Reed Moi, who would yell out codes about where the ball was going. So not only could I create these uncrackable codes using letter substitutions, using unique strikes of consonants, but I could also decode the opposition's cipher without letting on. That was the trick, to actually crack the enemy empire's code, but not to betray the fact that you have inside knowledge.
Tell me, David, about your pen pal, LB, who later became your mentor.
He is a very seminal figure in my life because LB, whose name was Lindsay Brown, and he had a very quirky spelling. He's the first name was L-I-N-D-S-E-Y, as he said, anagram of Snidely, and Brown was with an E. So he always was very pedantic about it, how he spelled his name, and pedantic about his crossword making. He made such celebratory, witty crosswords for the Sydney Morning Herald and was essentially a turbine of one for most of the 60s and 70s. And consequently, to enter the realm of cryptic crosswords as a Sydney boy was to enter LB's imagination. And eventually, through this series of letters that I sent him, including my very first efforts at crossword making, we developed an old-fashioned pen pal correspondence. And it was very, it was a wonderful and terrifying moment when I did eventually meet him.
Could you talk to each other through crosswords?
We do, and in fact, that's quite true. When I went to meet him, and even before he put pen to paper as a letter writer, I knew him instinctively because I could recognise within his canon of clues what delighted him, what he disdained. I just knew his sensibilities. So when
the crossword speaks of someone's preferences, like sports, preference of sports and literature as well?
Well, very much. In fact, recently I made a clue where the answer was ohm, O-H-M, and the definition for ohm was power. Now, I was told by 10 people at least through blogs and letters and just people in the street who know me, they said, don't you know that ohm is not power but a unit of resistance? Now, clearly I didn't, and it was a mistake, but even from my mistakes, people would get to know what are my fortes, what are my passions, where my politics lie, where my aesthetics lie, because it's very difficult to be to be robotic in this art form. It is a very expressive art form as much as it is a deceptive one.
The code under the code.
It is. That's right. In fact, people, once or twice I've had someone who's bumped into me and has worked out that I am DA, and they've more or less said, no, you're not. You're not who I expected. You're not the person that I claimed to have in my mind. It's almost as though because I don't match their sort of preconception, therefore I can't be DA, which is, I think that's something, that's entering gestalt.
I know. I imagine that sometimes though perhaps they think of you as this kind of robed god sitting on a cloud sort of nutting out these puzzles from that Olympian perspective.
I think that's the very flattering point of view. I think it's actually something far more scurrilous.
So when you'd been sending letters back and forth with LB, the cryptic crossword guy from the Sydney Morning Herald, what happened when you went to actually meet him, David?
It's a little like when you meet your mother-in-law, Richard. Now, that can be an exciting moment, but it's also telling you that this is your future. That is, when you meet the girl of your dreams, when you meet her mum, I hope that you get on, because that person's going to be in your life, and in fact, your wife may embody many of your mother-in-law's qualities. That idea of the apprentice and the mentor, eventually, one day, you will graduate into the mentor or something similar. So when I went to see Lindsay, he lived in this chaotic household in Greenwich in Sydney. I say chaotic because there was a sort of farting bulldog in the kitchen and he sat at the kitchen table with dictionaries everywhere. He was a quiz genius. He earned a lot of money on quizzes and in fact helped to bankroll his first wife's cancer treatment with quiz winnings. He was a wonderful man and he was such a pleasure to meet, but I could also see in him my own future because I was so besotted by crosswords, as was he, that I knew this was eventually my destiny, sitting in that kitchen with the farty dog.
It seems like it's a bit like the Dalai Lama and the Panchen Lama or something. And eventually, I don't know, I'm guessing at some point as you get older, you'll start to get correspondence from a young David Astle type person, or man or woman, as it may be, and that person may meet you and then become the anointed one to follow in your footsteps. Because there aren't many people who can do this, are there, David?
They're not. Look, there's quite a few people who aspire to do it, and you do need to have that It is that je ne sais quoi. It is that X factor that identifies an aspiring compiler and someone who just breaks out of the stable and identifies them as having their own style, their own perspective. So what you're seeing is not this sort of tedious continuum, or in fact it is a continuum, but it's an extension of what's gone before. Now, I don't know whether LB sensed that in me, but possibly he sensed the potential for me to be that person. But certainly in the last couple of years, I have helped to finesse a couple of aspiring compilers, and just quietly one or two, I think, may well have the right stuff. But time will tell.
David Astle is my guest in conversation. He's the crossword compiler. I like the term writer, actually. Mm-hmm. Writer is probably, because it's a creative act, what you do. It's very playful and creative. For the who contributes regularly to the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age in Melbourne. His book is called Puzzled, Secrets and Clues from a Life Lost in Words. So did he help your LB, did he help you get your first gig then as a printed compiler slash writer?
He did, but he was also, thankfully, quite stern too, because I was still at uni at that stage. I was in my early 20s, 21, and I was creating a lot of very cheeky and maverick clues. And he didn't want to quash that creativity, but he did tell me that I needed to sort of settle down a bit, and was just going through my clues quite patiently. In fact, very patiently for a man who was as busy and as ennobled as he was. And it was probably a mentorship of 3 years or so before finally I was ready to appear sporadically. And I think that year was 1983. So
that was
a long
your first
time
cryptic
ago.
Crossword. That's when it was published.
That's right.
In the Sydney Morning Herald.
Sydney Morning Herald. That's right.
And what was that like for you? I mean, you must have been nervous. I mean, because you know, people are quite demanding about the quality of their crosswords, aren't they?
They are. And in fact, I think there's I can't remember the film, but there was one of. It was one of those sort of Broadway movies where the playwright finally gets his big play up on up in lights, and he runs around and grabs every paper from the newsstand to sort of get the reviews. I felt a bit like that. I felt as though I had to buy every newspaper I could see, because that crossword, this is long before initials identified the grid, that crossword was mine. And I was walking up and down the old Red Rattler trains in Sydney, like a ticket collector, just seeing if anyone was having a go and leaning over and giving them advice. I was just painfully, painfully proud.
Was it your cryptic crossword abilities that actually won you your wife?
Those abilities eventually did win over Tracy, but it was not before we had this office enmity. I was always very chatty. She was very driven, chasing deadlines in a publishing house. But it was when she realised that my other identity, my Riddler self or alter ego, was a crossword compiler, and that she loved my crosswords without putting the nuisance in the office and the compiler in the same, you know, in the same sentence, let alone in the same body. She felt it was star-crossed, and I was the same.
Do you remember the clue that won her over?
I do. Well, I wish it was a little bit more elegant, but it was, let me think, leading snag rock and roller. And rock and roller is a leading snag. And the answer was headbanger. A leading snag being a headbanger or sausage.
The name for people who are crossword enthusiasts is, just discovered this reading a book, is cruciverbalist. And you've got a great quote from The Simpsons there where Lisa comes home and says, "Guess what, Mum? I'm a cruciverbalist." "Oh, Lisa, another religion. You know, you'll just drop the whole thing at college when you get a Jewish boyfriend." But it is like a religion, isn't it?
It is a religion. We are an esoteric coterie, and my obsession lasted beyond campus too.
There's a cult that forms around it. Tell me, as you understand it, how Geoffrey Rush, who admires your work, managed to spread the love of the cryptic crossword amongst his co-stars while making Pirates of the Caribbean.
I was you know, dumbfounded when I was reading a profile of Geoffrey Rush in Melbourne, and you know, I'm a great admirer of his work, and along came a quote sort of two-thirds of the way through the article. The journalist was Melinda Houston. She asked Rush, "So what do you do away from the stage? You know, how do you distract yourself?" And he actually said, "Well, I just turn to crosswords." And in fact, DA is the Sergeant Pepper of cryptic crosswords, a complete mind F with four stars. And I thought, three stars. I thought, here is a five-star actor being totally, embedded in cryptic crosswords. And when I had the honour in the same year to interview him, I think it when he was doing that Ionesco play, "The King Is Dead," and I felt so thrilled to meet him. I played Scrabble with him as an interview, and he then told me this great story that when they were filming Pirates of the Caribbean, that is with Orlando Bloom, Bill Nye.
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp, of course. Jack Sparrow. They would be using the crossword off the set, and a little bit of a race amongst the thespes to see who could actually get this crossword out first. And, of course, you know, Jeffrey had a head start with a long training.
Who else was good?
Orlando Bloom was
Orlando
very good.
Orlando Bloom.
As you would expect with a name like that.
With a name like that?
Well, Orlando is a Virginia Woolf novel, and Bloom, of course, is the hero of Ulysses.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. Conversations, broadcast, podcast, and online.
DA, alias David Astle, is here, the man who compiles cryptic crosswords in major newspapers in Australia. His book is called Puzzled, Secrets and Clues from a Life Lost in Words. When you were talking about just how you manipulate letters when you create anagrams on the fly, you were doing this like typing motion almost with your fingers. And I was wondering if you were sort of using those fingers kind of to rearrange Scrabble tiles in your head. Is that what you do? Do you feel the letter in your mind?
I do feel letters. In fact, I think the analogy may be closer to composition. I love music, but I don't read music. But I know that composers try and create those resonances of chords and resonances of notes. And so often when I'm thinking about words, I do see them as shapes. I always think of the letters actually in lowercase, so every letter therefore has a distinctive shape.
Because lowercase?
Well, look, block letters, ABC, it's just staring back at me like an acronym or a rubber stamp. But if I see the letters ABC in lowercase, then they're quite different characters literally. And I love them for that. I love them for having their different body types. And so when I'm moving letters around, I'm moving shapes around.
I suppose that gives you more variety too, doesn't it, with tall sticks and things that drop below and all that?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's also too, it's interesting when you think, well, what words have similar profiles? You can just go off on these fascinating tangents too.
Where do crosswords come from?
Well, in fact, they're coming up to their golden jubilee. They're almost 100 years old. 2013 will be their 100-year anniversary, because back in 1913, there was a Liverpudlian expat sub-editor. I love saying that. His name was Arthur Wynne, and he was living in New York and was working on a newspaper called the New York World. And it was around Christmas time, 1913, silly season. He was filling out this kids' supplement that had a few games and distractions, and he was hoping that an ad would arrive to block out the space in the last page, but that ad never appeared. So he had to create something out of necessity, which we know is the mother of invention. And what he created, he called a word cross, and it was a diamond-shaped sort of argyle pattern with the word fun at three across. Now, while that there were precursors to a word square, that is, where you put four words inside a 4x4 block in the 1800s, the innovation that Arthur Wynne created and, in fact, revolutionised the genre was aligning clues with numbers inside the grid that flowed naturally downwards from north to south. And it was that innovation, as simple as it sounds these days, that actually created this furious fad in New York.
What about symmetry? Because, you know, people who don't do crosswords don't really notice the fact that they're symmetrical. The blacks and whites balance out across the one axis of symmetry at least, or is it two? I don't know.
It can be both. In the American crossword, it is always 360 symmetry, so it's a symmetry from the two sides. But it can occasionally, in the cryptic, which is more of a waffle pattern, where only every second letter is crossed, it can actually be a 180-degree symmetry. But I'll tell you a fascinating thing about Pompeii, because just to prove that, in fact, word squares and a fascination with words has, you know, pre-existed Arthur Wynne's brainwave, and that was when they were scratching around in Pompeii. Now, bear in mind the eruption of Vesuvius, I think, was 79 AD. So this is, you know, the first century AD. They came across a word square that was scratched on the walls of Pompeii. Now, it was a 5x5, and it said, if I remember right, Sartor Arepo Tenet Opera Rotas. And translated, that means Arepo has his hand on the plough, on the plough. And for years, scholars thought this was actually some religion. But in fact, they've come to realise that it was just a symptom of the human fascination with letters and symmetry and patterns, and in fact, a precursor to the crossword.
I read in a history book once that in one of the brothels of Pompeii, they found the words Hic Messius Fituit Nihil, which is translated unbroadcastable, actually, as it turns out. And very amusing.
That's right. Creatures of the flesh and the mind, obviously.
There are overarching rules for a cryptic crossword, aren't they? Rules that you feel obliged to obey 100% of the time or 99% of the time?
This is the point where I should probably fess up and saying, look, I do enjoy stretching and bending the rules, seeing how far they can go before they ping, a bit like a hamstring at the age of 40. There are rules, and in fact, probably the better word to say is that there's a code of etiquette. And that etiquette entails such rules as that every clue must contain a definition and a wordplay, that the link between the definition and the target answer is clear, that there is no word wasted. So every word in that clue is doing its job. Otherwise, it is a love handle and needs to be sweated off or paired. There needs to be a surface sense is very important in a crossword.
What do you mean?
Let's say that green suede shoe clue that I gave you, that created an image for you. You were off thinking about Elvis Presley. Now, that is because the surface sense was quite good. But if I said I said green suede curtains inside to follow, even though that meets the criteria of definition and wordplay, the surface sense is really not there. It's just nonsense. So it needs to have that seamless dovetailing between the two elements. And if you get that right, then you create that literalism, that idea that the reader or the sort of callow solver reads that and goes off in this merry meadow, which is the wrong direction. And that is the payoff for a compiler.
And then even better with green suede shoes, because there's a trap. Because you've misled me, haven't you, thinking there's an Elvis Carl Perkins connection there?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, in fact, if I say to you, bull-tossed lean boy.
Tossed is the operative word there, isn't it?
It is.
To mix up the letters?
It is. Now, it's a seven-letter word you're seeking, and lean boy adds up to seven letters.
Okay, I can't do that off the top of my head.
But you know that bull will be the answer because that's
right.
The other element in this clue. And that, if you mix up lean boy, you get baloney, which is bull. But you can see how that surface sense creates this idea of El Toro tossing a child in a paddock, which has got it's got nothing to do with what the answer is, but everything to do with the deception and the surface sense.
Yeah, and I was trying to sort of flip lean boy to get me a kind of breed of cattle. And again, that's me being too literal, isn't it? Meaning lots of different things. That's the pleasure of it.
There's no harm in being literal, because the pleasure of solving a crossword too is to be literal, enjoy the surface sense, and then to plunge below the surface and be lateral.
David Astle, do you catch public transport in Sydney and Melbourne merely to perv on people as they do your cryptic crossword? Do you like watching people do your crossword?
No, I like to do it myself as well, but not my own crossword. I do take pleasure in seeing people solve crosswords, even in planes. If they're doing a crossword, I always have a little sideways glance to see how they're faring. But I also love public transport because it's where you can harvest language. You just hear phrases like "didn't get the memo," which is 15 letters, perfect for a spinal column.
What's the piñata principle you talk about with crosswords?
It's a very important one, and that's another part of this encoded etiquette, and that is you do need to be solved. You need to be cracked. And for me, the metaphor is a piñata, because you may create this beautiful peacock of crepe paper and plaster, but if that peacock doesn't break open and if wonderful lollies don't spill from its belly, then you have made a very poor piñata. So you do need another compiler that I really admire from the UK called John Halpin, whose code name is Mud with two Ds, because his girlfriend left him and that's how she saw him. He phrases it differently by saying that it is the art of losing gracefully. So in other words, you're creating this challenge, but you ultimately wish to be solved. You wish to be cracked.
When you've set yourself your own challenge as a cracker of crossword puzzles, mm-hmm. and you set yourself a challenge, I think it was to solve 100.
That's right.
Every day on the day, and on the day of publication of the crossword. How far have you gotten with that?
Well, in fact, just to clarify, I solve at least one crossword a day. I probably solve four or five, but I turn to the one source and try and solve. In this case, it's the Times and the Australian. I try and solve that every day, and I got as far as the mid 90s. I'm trying to, crack a century. The rules are.
Oh no! You got somewhere in the 90s, did you?
Oh, and I actually lost my leg bail. With a very obscure reference to Edward Lear that I didn't pick up.
Why? Why didn't? What? How were you trapped with that clue?
It all they gave me was Lear and a compound anagram, and I was thinking it was a reference to King Lear. And I actually spent a little illegally, because you're not allowed to have any reference books, but because I was on 96, I went through King Lear from Act One to the final scene, looking for this quote. And it was Edward Lear. It was the Akond of Swat, which is one of his nonsense poems.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's cruel.
Oh, it was cruel.
But then, as you say, you have to lose gracefully, don't you?
You do. And for me, the greatest sin is for a solver to say, I got the answer, but I didn't know how. And even when sort of fellow solvers clarify how it works, and for that person still not to see, or the majority not to see, I feel as though I've failed as a crossword maker. It's important that that aha moment is lurking somewhere along the line.
Do you compulsively make anagrams? Is it impossible to stop your mind from making anagrams?
You mentioned the analogy of a strong narrative, and I think it's a strong narrative reading a book. If I can read a book without seeing all the potential of the words on the page, the puzzle potential, then that is a fine book. And same with, I do really enjoy, I have a overwalked dog. I love just walking. I love just running too. I just like to get out and leave language behind.
Every once in a while we find ourselves stuck in situations where we have to sit and be quiet for long periods of time. It's through something that's unspeakably desperately boring.
Yeah.
It happens every once in a while. It could be international travel or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing. There's nothing there for you. My trick is to try and sort of remember all 50 states of the United States. And that sort of thing. I can't imagine the riot that's going on in your head under those situations where you are forced to sit still, not do anything, in deeply boring circumstances for long periods of time.
No, that's it. I seldom get bored for that reason, because I often have these distractions. For example, someone made an observation to me recently that president of the Federal Reserve in the US is called Ben Bernanke. Now, if you mix up Bernanke, inside his name is banker. And so therefore I thought, well, what other people in the world have their job title lurking in their name? And Bruce Springsteen, singer, Calista Flockhart, actor, Banjo Patterson, poet, Serpico was a cop. And as soon as you just give those little, you just set yourself these little tasks. So I might fly all the way to Singapore and be overjoyed to reach Calista Flockhart by the time I get there.
So to speak.
Yeah. Don't take that quite out of context, please.
Do you see it as, like you say, it sounds like it can be a hindrance at times, because it must be very hard, as you say, to complete a novel. But when you're seeing all these possibilities leap out from every single word that will lead you onto another story.
No, it's a very astute question, because, in fact, that's the curse of it. At times I wish that I could just take away, peel off the you know, the Riddler leotard, and just essentially look at words for what they are. But even seeing a boring document, I'm collecting jargon, or I'm looking for anagrams, or possibly acrostics in the left-hand margin. It is just this restless dog that I carry with me. But the dog's been very kind to me, and it's been a great companion too.
When you're having people talk to you, at you, for mm-hmm. long periods, you know, there's another episode of The Simpsons where I think Mr. Burns is trying to give Homer baseball instructions, and Homer's just switching off, and you go into his internal dialogue, and he's just going, chicken. That's it. Is that like you for you when someone's trying to give you long, boring, detailed instructions? Do you start to flip the words around?
Yeah, but in fact, my brain is the rotisserie. It's the one that's turning around, and it's basted by language.
Beautiful metaphor. Is music then a relief? Because that can really beguile you out of words, can't it?
Very true. And in fact, driving to and fro, I tend to, if I can't find a fascinating interview or a documentary, then I'll just turn straight to music. And I actually enjoy, I am a big fan of Radiohead. I don't mind stuff that's actually quite... creates a world that you can just drop yourself into. Doves is another one. They kind of create soundscapes. I do enjoy that. Nick Cave, I'm also really a fan of, because they have the foregrounding of sound, and sometimes the words are incidental, and that thrills me.
Do other languages have cryptic crosswords?
It's a great question, and they've got variations, but they don't have a true equivalent. The closest that I know of, at least, and there may be listeners out there who know of a non-English cryptic, there is an Italian magazine that comes out every week called Enigmatica Semana, or Semana Enigmatica. Sorry about that translation. And they have these really clever rebus and... word squares that are close to cryptics, but more in a kind of mechanical double entendre way rather than all the recipes of a true cryptic.
It's interesting that there's so little of it then, really. I mean, this is just the exception, really. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that there isn't a culture of cryptic crosswords in other languages?
For me, the explanation is quite simple, and that's because a British philologist, a lover of words, who's called David Crystal, identified English as being the most hospitable language in the world. It is. We have an open door policy. We take words from around the world. You know, we have dashas from Russia. We have barbecues from Cuba. We have entrepreneur. Yeah, we have sauna from Finland. We have words from everywhere. We have American slang. We have we have tech speak. We'll take it all on. Whether it stays in the house for a sleepover, that's another question. But we'll certainly have them over for the evening. And I think it's this open-door policy that creates this diversity of language that is English, that creates so many secret words and patterns and meanings and potential. I think because a lot more languages are a little insular in comparison, it actually limits your palate as a word composer, puzzle composer.
There's no police for the English language. There are many people who'd like... language and the English language to be like modernist architecture, I think, all sort of run on logical lines and having great clarity and elegance and simplicity. But really we should see it as some kind of ramshackle old overgrown garden, shouldn't we?
There's a wonderful absurdist play by the Czech writer who actually was the Czech leader for a while, Václav Havel, called The Memorandum. And it was about these bureaucrats who tried to reduce language to numbers, whereas the number one would be the, and the number two is power, and the number three meant government. And I think Wombat was 129, which was actually...
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
For Wombat.
But that was... It just highlighted the absurdity of trying to create modernist architecture out of language. It does need to be ramshackle and does need to be overgrown and only lightly tended.
There is a bit of panic that goes on every once in a while about text-speak that you mentioned. Text-speak, mm-hmm. as in, you know, LOL for laughing out loud, GR number eight for great, and the like. How do you feel about text-speak?
I embrace it. And in fact, ILI, I love it. And the reason why is because it shows a real dexterity with for you to make that gag with great, that is for a teenager to make that gag, they instinctively are understanding... homophone, they're borrowing from another sequence, that is number sequence, to create that sound. I find that thrilling. And I actually think potentially there's a couple of great puzzle makers to come out of the Z or the iGen.
Why are there so few cryptic crosswords in America, do you think?
I think it's because it is wrongly identified as being an Anglo-centric pursuit. There is a little bit more chafing that goes on between the US and UK in a lot of other cultural areas. They've embraced Britpop, but it's always seen as being Britpop comes from over there, and it's not seen with the same delirium that their own acts are seen. It's not xenophobic as much, but what it is, the Americans themselves have created a wonderful genre of crosswords that are just as inventive and just as ingenious. Cryptics, on the other hand, do require a level of finesse and lightness of touch that is quite difficult to master quickly. And it, therefore, because they're impatient to learn, and I'm being very general here, I think they see it more as it's something that is peculiar to the British, the British sensibility.
Maybe it's because Americans, I tend to find, like good, hard, direct language, whereas the English have always liked talking around things. Cockney rhyming slang is a great example of that.
It is.
And a way of talking in code about things and also flipping things around. In Australia, we like it too, don't we? Tall people are lofty, redheads are bluey.
That's true.
We like those kind of inversions of meaning that play around with things. And there was an old form of slang. The word yobbo, I think, comes from inversion of boy, doesn't it?
Yob, that's right,
is an inversion of boy, because there was a passion amongst in the East End of London in the turn of the last, well, the century before last, for speaking in reverse, like reeb would be beer, for example.
Well, in fact, one theory is the word nerd comes from the reversal of drunk, because a nerd is the opposite to get drunk. They are sort of a very bookish. It also possibly comes from Dr. Seuss, who created a nerd in If I Ran the Zoo. But getting back to the US direct language, there is a subculture of cryptic lovers in the US, but they are a minority, and I think that is certainly one strong reason. They enjoy that sort of go-to definition stuff.
I suppose that they risk being dubbed an Anglophile as well, for doing that. Can you describe what happens to you when you consider a word and a phrase? Take me through the mental process of how you do that.
Okay, well, look, dangerously, when I was going on a long drive to Gippsland recently, I saw the word power nap. And rather than pulling over, I decided to play with that word for a few miles. And I thought, power nap it's a great 8 letters. It's wonderful because it ends in P. And you look for words that actually have strong letters and ideally strong openers or closers, because it creates an interesting hem around your grid. The other wonderful thing about power nap is it's an anagram of two opposites. Getting back to Lad and Girl with Gillard, it's wrap and open. So I'm already starting to think about what I can do with this word. I'm also thinking about power nap is an anagram of owner inside pap, which is baby food. Pap's also reversible, so it's food that comes up and tastes just the same. I'm looking at a word, I'm thinking of all the playful possibilities that it possesses, and then I will list it. I keep these arcane books, look a little like books of spells, and that would immediately go in my 8-letter column. And when it comes to composing, I start to look at my columns for the freshest catches and see what I can throw in. So that's the start.
Joyous to hear you talk like that. It's really lovely. It's lovely. Same time as I hear you say that, I'm sort of reminded of that scene in A Beautiful Mind, where Russell Crowe is the maths genius who undergoes a form of schizophrenia, which means he sees that kind of code in language but thinks it means something, that he's being spoken to from it. Do you think there's any... I mean, neither you or I are a psychiatrist or psychologist. No. Do you think there's anything... Is your... Something what you have is a bit like a happier form of that kind of
I think it
disorder.
Is. Mm. I think it is. It's a disorder that I've actually turned into a vocation. And I think that if I was to sort of foster it too strongly, that it actually could become quite an obstacle to sort of social discourse and fitting into a society. But so, for example, when you said Russell Crowe, I thought, well, crow again is a contronym, because crow is a homophone of to boast, but his surname is an anagram of cower, which is the opposite, you know, which is to actually be So he's someone who is very bold, but he's also terrified. Now, I can see that and enjoy it, but I also heard your question and responded to it, but in the back of the mind, I'm storing that as a possible clue or puzzle. So I can live on those two tiers.
And I think the reason why I'm laughing is because it's a happy thing what you do. It's like a magic trick in a way. You know, magic is just changing the perception of something through just an idea, really, I suppose, and presenting it like that. Do you think of it in that way?
I do, in fact. You know, I love the idea of close magic, you know, performing just right in front of your eyes and, you know, a coin can appear between the opposite knuckle. I love that sort of close magic, not that I can do it myself, but the equivalent for me is to just manipulate letters in small and subtle ways and show you these hidden truths or spectacular secrets lying inside the words that we see every day.
And there's plenty of clues in your own name too, isn't there? David Astle, that's one of the first things you played around with, wasn't it?
Well, in fact, it is the perfect surname. I felt as almost though it was a destiny calling, because if you mix up the letters of Astle, A-S-T-L-E, you get 11 different anagrams. And I can't think of too many other surnames that could be as bountiful as that.
Can you take me through some of them?
Well, common ones are Slate and Steel and Teals, the ducks. Then you've got words like Stale, and getting into the more obscure ones, you've got Leets, which are mill streams. You've got Tails, T-A-E-L-S, which are Chinese units of measurement. You've got Tesla, the inventor. You've got Stella, S-T-E-L-A, which is a stone column. I'm sure of course, and last but not least, don't forget least.
David Astle, how delightful to meet you. I so enjoyed having you on Conversation.
Thanks so much.
You've been a wonderful guest. Thank you.
Pleasure, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.